As a non-commercial educational radio station, KZSC supports the free expression of ideas. Please be aware that the opinions expressed are those of the speakers or artists only, and do not necessarily reflect the views of the UC Regents, KZSC staff, management, or underwriters. We welcome your feedback on our programming. Please direct your comments to the Program Review Committee at 831-459-4726 or by email at prc@kzsc.org. Welcome to the Pandemoscene podcast. Today we welcome you to a conversation with Kim Tallbear and Jessica Kalapanuk, two Indigenous scholars at the University of Alberta, Canada. They are the co-founders and principal investigators of Indigenous Science, Technology, and Society, a research training program that supports Indigenous-led techno-scientific innovation and knowledge production in an effort to create infrastructure for Indigenous self-determination. Among other things, we talk about their upcoming open access course on Indigenous peoples and pandemics, what a productive embrace of crisis looks like, and how understanding our relations as kin on Earth might help us live better together on stolen land. This interview was conducted by Issa Ansari, an undergraduate fellow with the Science and Justice Research Center, and Dennis Brow, graduate student researcher. We start by talking about an open access course on Indigenous peoples and pandemics that Dr. Tallbear and Dr. Kalapanuk are in the process of developing. The first voice you will hear this evening is Jessica Kalapanuk, followed directly by Kim Tallbear.
We're in this kind of unique situation, or maybe not so unique situation in Alberta right now, where the pandemic striked, happened, and then also it coincided with major cuts to universities from our provincial budget. So we're in this situation where we wanted to engage first of all with what's happening in the world right now, and how it relates to Indigenous peoples. And then also we're in a position where we need to be thinking about other forms of engagement that the university can, that we can do in the Faculty of Native Studies in light of these really severe provincial budget cuts. So we thought about doing this really short kind of mini course on Indigenous peoples and pandemics that would be open to all, with the idea that we can plug this into a broader course that we're going to develop for, I think, next winter term. So January 2021, on Indigenous peoples and science. So this will be like one kind of small unit within that broader course.
Yeah, I think because the pandemic happened, our SING program was supposed to take place July 5th through the 11th this summer. Mm-hmm. And so we decided to cancel that, obviously, back at the beginning. And I don't remember how we got on the idea of doing the course instead. I think it sort of coincided with the fact that our dean was thinking about extending the footprint of the Faculty of Native Studies, because we do have the largest group of Indigenous scholars in Canada. We might have the largest in the world, right? In one unit. Yeah. And so we get asked a lot constantly every day in our inboxes, we're getting asked to go on grants with scientists and medical researchers, and we're always being asked by people across other faculties in the university to come on to their projects with them, because the federal research agencies in Canada require Indigenous participation, and most of these researchers don't have contacts with Indigenous communities. So our dean and we decided might be a really good use of our time to actually disseminate a lot of what we're doing through it's not a massive online course, but it is going to be an online course that we will be based at the University of Alberta within the Faculty of Native Studies, although this Indigenous Peoples and Pandemics unit is being co-produced with faculty from our Faculty of Science and our medical school faculty. So I think that'll be a three faculty kind of co-sponsored unit. And that will go into the broader course that Jess was talking about that will be, I think, offered for credit at the University of Alberta, but it'll also be offered, we haven't figured out the mechanism yet, to lifelong learners, and then available to students in universities across Canada. We're still figuring that out. I guess obviously globally people could tap into it as well, but we're not yet sure what the accrediting mechanism is for all of that.
Yeah, and I guess what I think is really interesting about our Indigenous Peoples and Pandemics mini courses is the strong interdisciplinary approach that we're taking, working with colleagues in public health, medicine, and science. So we're integrating like the biology and epidemiology of a number of diseases, and incorporating that with all of the kinds of context that you need to understand in terms of infectious disease and Indigenous communities.
That brings me to this question of, so you mentioned that there's a 3 faculty co-sponsored class, and that this interdisciplinary approach is really central to the class. Are there any other inspiring ways that you've seen your colleagues working together across disciplines in response to the pandemic, and in any new ways that you haven't seen before this moment?
I mean, I think in the Faculty of Native Studies, you know, we're our own faculty, like our own college, right? We're not simply a department, we have our own dean. So I actually don't spend a lot of time with people in other faculties professionally. So it's hard to, I mean, I have friends across campus, right? So we are seeing, what I'm seeing is a lot of lamentation of people still adjusting, right? Psychically and professionally to this transition across campus. I think, and Jess, correct me if you have a different impression, but mm-hmm. I feel like within our faculty, we're not, I mean, personally, some people are struggling, right? Because some people are extroverted and have a harder time, right? Or have small children or have circumstances that make it a bit more difficult. But I feel like professionally, when we get together in our every other week faculty Zoom meetings, we're not spending most of our time lamenting what's happening. We are just, you know, I don't mean to be cliche, but I think it's true. Indigenous peoples often, we come from communities and families that are living in crisis half the time. This is just another crisis. It's a big crisis, right? And it hurts. It's not like it doesn't hurt our communities. But my mom once said something to me. She's like, you know, Native people are best in crisis. We just start organizing. We just start trying to figure out what to do. And I do feel sometimes like we are almost better in crisis than we are in a calm, everyday, normal life, right? Yeah. So that's what we're doing. We're like, okay, if we're going to go mostly online, how are we going to continue to do that while still maintaining community and relating to community? I just posted something to Twitter yesterday. You can look at it if you want, but we've already had elders, I think, doing songs and stories online. We've got a Native Student Resource Center that's working with elders. We have community contacts in our faculty. So life is difficult right now, but I feel like our brains are firing as a faculty about what we're going to do with this.
Yeah. So. Yeah, it's so true, Kim. When things are too calm,
you make crisis. it's so dysfunctional. But then when you're in a situation like this, it's actually super functional.
Yeah, kind of because you have those coping skills and strategies and mechanisms and stuff. Mm-hmm.
When we had major floods hit my reservation about 10 years ago, the tribe was hauling elders to the hotel. The white people were like, what do we do? What do we do? And the tribe is the one hauling all the old people in the country, even the white people, into hotels, helping them out because they just know how to organize in crisis.
Yeah. And it's funny because if you look historically as well, that was the case, right? Indigenous people helping the new settlers like figure stuff out, especially in times of crisis. I've been reaching out to some of the older members of my family back home on our reserve, and just hearing some recollections that they have from the 1918 Spanish flu. And like we are living at a time with living memories from that previous pandemic in our families. And so that is really a source of knowledge and strength, I think, that we can draw on.
As the conversation developed, Dr. Talbert continued to touch on what a productive embrace of crisis might look like, and how Indigenous Science and Technology Studies, also known as Indigenous STS, is equipped to engage with crisis in such a way.
For me, again, the transition that universities are having to make to doing more online education, and then thinking about, I just read an article, they're calling it like high flex, hybrid, flexible classroom or something. So what I've discovered is I'm just really super interested. We're working with a creative and technical team at the University of Alberta to do this online course who have a lot of experience doing this. I'm really interested in the technology and the creative side because I've been doing so much podcasting lately, and I've been increasingly doing a lot of media interviews, and I go into both do interviews from home, podcasting from home, and I go into pretty well-equipped professional studios. And I've gotten really interested in actually the mics and the recording technology and the online platforms and the different ones you can use and how you put together a production like that. So I think this is fascinating, and I actually don't care if I ever go back to the classroom. I love the technical side of this and the ability to reach more people. And so I decided to stay here this year and work on that. And in part, some of us doing that and embracing that, I think we can have a big philosophical discussion about this, but I think that helps make more space for the people who want to stay in the classroom and go back to the classroom. That's not a place I really care about being. I want to be in a kind of broader virtual classroom. I like being in conversation with a lot of people, and I like talking to students, but I don't actually enjoy at all the production of a traditional classroom method. It's just not, I don't like it. I don't know. I think I like the technology more. I like the interface more. So, and which is good, I think, because we are having to make that transition. So that's kind of what I'm really interested in that. I mean, this pandemic course actually draws on Jessica's research. It doesn't draw on my research at all, right? So it's kind of her intellectual content a lot. And then she's been the main one working with the public health and the med school people. But we could actually incorporate that into thinking about Indigenous STS in general. How does our embrace of crisis, our productive embrace of crisis, our community relations, our existing community relations, how does that tie into a different kind of response that we might have? Because that might set Indigenous STS apart, right? I don't know where the rest of the field is. Often I think about traditional STS as social scientists and humanities scholars who study scientists, but we don't just study them, we help train them, you know, because we don't see, and that goes back to fundamentally, we don't see a divide as much between the knowing inquirer and the subject of research. We are all in a group, you know, me and the scientists I interview, or the scientists that we help train. We are all in a group, co-thinkers. And so in our Sing summer program, we have science faculty, we have Native Studies faculty, we have undergraduate and graduate aspiring Indigenous scientists, we have community people, sometimes who tend to be older, who are in regulatory positions in the community or positions of cultural and knowledge authority. We're all sitting in a classroom together, understanding that the project is to produce Indigenous genome scientists, but it's so much more than that. It's to produce that in the service of Indigenous communities having governance and cultural authority over the kind of research that happens in their communities. And so this is a collaborative co-thinking project, right? And so yes, Jess and I also do our own social science research that looks a little bit more like traditional STS, but it's really coming out of this place where we're sitting in community as co-thinkers between scientists, social scientists, community people, even children will come in. Sometimes people will bring their kids. So I don't know if that.
Yeah, no, that is definitely touches on it. And I really appreciate what you said about this productive embrace of crisis and how that might look like this willingness to shift to this online platform, because you do see a lot of resistance and pushback to that among a lot of people in our academic community at UC Santa Cruz.
I think people think it's an all or nothing, though.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and sure. That's not how you respond to crisis, right? It is not an all or nothing. I don't understand. But I think that point of view comes out of the settler culture is deeply evangelical. If they're not evangelizing Christianity, they're evangelizing science and reason, or they're evangelizing capitalism. They're so like, there has to be one right way to do things.
Right. Right. And like you said, you know, having people who are willing to make that transition over to an online format and embrace that also allows for there to be more space for people who are more interested in that classroom
I hope, right? You've got to push back against the neoliberal administrators that want to, you know, that's right. a whole other, and I get the worry about that. People are like, well, if we do this, then they're going to want to do everything that way.
Right.
So
thank you so much for that. I want to address an article that you wrote, Dr. Talbert, last spring. It was published last spring, Caretaking Relations, Not American Dreaming. In that article, you write, you cite making kin as a potential creative alternative to nationalist assertions of inherent sovereignty and to narratives of progress toward a multicultural future that neglects Indigenous people and histories of dispossession altogether. I wonder, what does making kin look like generally and in the context of COVID-19?
I remember in that article, I really had a big light bulb over my head moment when I came to Canada. And I cite Rob Innes's work in there, Jess, pretty prominently in his book, Elder Brother. When I read that book and then I was listening to Indigenous people from Canada talk about this like treaty history, and the way that they sometimes, we only interpret treaties in our present moment in the United States. I don't know about histories of thought around that, but we talk about it very much as nation to nation, government to government. We don't talk about settlers historically as kin in a treaty relationship and an attempt to make. And when I came here, I was like, what? You know, the fact that Indigenous people up here, as far as I can tell, interpret that treaty history somewhat as not only a nation to nation thing, but as a desire to draw people into kinship obligations. Mm-hmm. And Rob talks about that a lot in his book, right? And he makes an argument that we can't only have transitioned into this nation kind of thinking that we did post like mid 19th century, but you have to remember that there was also kin attempting to be made. That just blew my mind. And then I read that and I thought about my own Dakota history, and it made me reread Little Crow, my four greats grandfather, who was pulled reluctantly as a leader into a war against settlers in what became Minnesota. And because Little Crow is remembered as like, what the heck was he doing? Why did he keep trying to negotiate and reach out to these settlers when it was clear they were going to incarcerate people in prison camps? They wanted to starve them. They wanted to completely remove them from their land. Well, making kin had worked historically because traders had been coming in there since the 17th century. So for 100 to 150 years before the settlers ended up taking over and establishing their own governmental form in the mid-1860s around Civil War time, that strategy had worked for quite a few generations, and we forget about that, right? So then I went and reread my own history and understood my own ancestor more and what his strategy was. I didn't really understand it. And I think a lot of non-Native historians that we have learned about him from don't understand that strategy of making kin either, which is why I think we also tend to forget about it. So that history was really interesting for me to think with. And it was very uncomfortable at first, but it seems to give us the only way forward to thinking about how to live well together on stolen land, right? Because I also never hear Indigenous people say, you'll get the occasional xenophobic, you know, Trump voting Native person, but most of us aren't like that. Most of us, like if you look at reservations across the United States, they go blue during elections, right? So, but it's not that there's no Native Trump supporters, but with rare exception, I don't hear Native people being xenophobic and saying, go back where you came from. What they say is respect this place and respect the peoples who were here, right? And so that kind of idea, it doesn't give you any guideposts for how to do that, right? But it does open up your imagination to the possibility. Mm-hmm. of entering into those kinds of relationships. And I don't remember how I ended that article. I mean, I'm not a planner anymore. I'm not really good on practical, how do we do this? Mm-hmm. Jess, do you have any thoughts on this question?
That's
your history up here, right?
Yeah, no, I never, cause it's so normalized for me, like making kin with the settlers. My people in particular, we sided with Scottish settlers over the Métis Nation. So we were in a shared territory, and our First Nation was like, no, those Métis are like crazy and they're trying to take over everything. And we had like kinship relationships with these white Scottish settlers. And so that for me in my own history like seems kind of normalized. So I appreciate hearing your experience confronting those histories, Kim, because I never thought of it in another way. Mm. And in terms of like, how do we go about doing that? I think there have been people, folks who work in Indigenous legal orders, and they're precisely trying to map out and sort out these kinds of things. Like, how can we draw on Indigenous legal orders to structure and manage our relationships with each other? So one of the things that I've heard suggested is, and it's just like a very basic kind of example, is finding out what word in the Indigenous language of the particular territory that you're in, like what word is used to describe newcomers or invaders or what have you. And so I've seen some really interesting words. So for example, on the Pacific Northwest coast, the Tsimshian people, their word for like settlers was translated to driftwood. So if you think about being driftwood in this particular territory, it invites you into that landscape and into a set of relationships. Like, what does it mean to be driftwood? What role does that serve in that particular territory? And so it actually brings people into that kinship relation rather than this focus of like native and settler, which creates this this different sort of divide.
Well, this goes back to one of the main projects of Indigenous studies, I think, across the world is language revitalization, right? I mean, you can't think outside a settler, evangelical, capitalistic worldview if you must use their language. I think you know when you spoke in multiple languages, right, how a new language opens up a new way of seeing the universe. And so even though I've not been a language revitalization person, I think it's probably the most important project we're doing in Indigenous studies globally. Because of that, it gives you a new way. Once you know how to say something, maybe you'll know how to act differently, right? It broadens your imagination to do that. It is really hard for us to think of better ways of living together, I think, in a language that is so incredibly violent historically, right? And so built around binaries, right? And moral absolutes, good and bad. It's so deeply baked into the English language that we use.
Yeah. Definitely. Thank you so much for those responses.
Transformation Highway is an interview and talk-based program exploring spirituality, social change, art, music, and local politics. Tune in every Thursday afternoon from 12 to 1 p.m. only on the Great 88 KZSC Santa Cruz. The Santa Cruz Resource Center for Nonviolence is hosting 5 book circles discussing key works on anti-racism, as well as histories of Black and Indigenous people of color in the Americas. The book circles will begin at the end of September. Meeting dates and registration information are available at rcnv.org.
So the question was kind of like, how can we draw on Indigenous knowledge or worldviews to inform kind of the science and public health approach to the current pandemic? And so my research, I've done a little bit of research more around tuberculosis because that continues to be an issue for a lot of Indigenous communities and remote Manitoba and Saskatchewan, and then further north as well. And so I was thinking a lot about kind of relations beyond the human. And so thinking about the bacteria themselves, the bacteria as a relation, like as a set of relations. It might be a pathological relation, but it's still, and if you look at humans, the development of humans, like it really has been a relational evolution with bacterium and viruses that one doesn't exist without the other, right? So thinking about things in terms of relationality rather than kind of this war against the evil bacteria or virus, I think is a little bit different of an approach.
We should end our course on that note, actually. there's on living with the virus, right, as a relation, because it isn't going away. Right. I mean, I'm pessimistic we're going to get a vaccine, but you know, I mean, so yeah, I think, so that's just a note. I think we should end on that note in our course.
As you can see here, this interview was a co-collaborative, generative process for all involved. And just as Dr. Talbert saw this as a good note to conclude on, we too want to leave you with this open-ended encouragement to consider deeply the systems of relations that we are all embedded in. How does honoring these relations as necessary conditions for life change the way we think about the more than human entities and beings, including viruses, that we coexist with? What metaphors present themselves when we consider SARS-CoV-2 as our relative in the Earth community rather than a foreign enemy? What if we located this enemy elsewhere, in the systems of domination and violence that made a pandemic like this possible? And with that, we would like to thank you for tuning in. Tune back in next week for another angle on the COVID-19 pandemic from the Pandemocene podcast. Thank you.